27th Vayisbeah.
The 27th of October, 1999, I put that on the tape because that's the right date, but my mind is still in the past. Okay, we are on Rosh Hashanah, Daf Tes, Amud Bet, okay? Daf Tes, Amud Bet. I want to summarize briefly what we had on the tape over here before we continue. Okay. You remember, part of the discussion that we had last week was based upon the fact that the concept of the Sifin Minachol Alakodesh, right? That you add from what is not holy to the holy. Okay. And there are two different opinions as to where in the Torah do we find it. Okay? One of the cases of the Akiva, for example, I mean, he finds it in the fact that we have this whole business, you know, about the Shemitah, that you have to have a certain period before and a period after, in which, you know, it's still, you have a prohibited period. So we'll be coming back to that again this evening. That's where he finds this basic idea. The other opinion was that we find it better from the business about Yom Kippur, because where it's written over there, you know, that, you know, the Tisha B'Chodesh Be'erev, right? On the ninth day in the evening, the Erev Averet, the Tisha B'Chem. So they deduce from this, that first of all, I mean, what do you mean the Tisha B'Erev? The Tisha means on the ninth day, are we fasting on the ninth day? Not fast. But we learn that you are to begin fasting mid-Odyo. But you do have to begin fasting while it's still daylight of the ninth day. Okay? This is why, for example, I indicate in the bulletin up to what time theoretically we can eat, and after that we cannot eat anymore. So it could always be mid-Odyo. Now this is true, of course, with Yisabot as well. So you all fast, okay? And but again, I mean, the proof is about Yom Kippur, right? And then how do we know that you also have to add afterwards according to this opinion? Because it says in the Erev Ad Erev, okay? Right, the Erev Ad Erev, which means that even in the following evening, you still have to add from the next night to the holiness of the day, right? Right. And then for the last two words of that passage, Tish Pesu Shabbat Hem,
that you shall observe your Sabbath, right?
Excuse me, I hope my voice is going to last tonight.
They deduce the fact that this applies not only to Shabbos, but it also applies to Yom Kippur.
Okay,
so that was part. So we established that point, and then the last point that they gave is that inasmuch as the first apostle, namely Rabbi Akiva, derives it from the business of Shabbos, Yovel, and so on, and then it's with the Shmias, you know, the seventh year in Yovel. So, for that particular reason, he had a different drash for the business, you know, about the Tisha B'Chodesh Be'erev, in order to teach us the fact that we don't, are we commanded to fast? Not commanded. But we learned that eating and drinking Erev Yom Kippur is as much a mitzvah as the fasting of the 10th day itself. Then we would start it on Tes Amud Beis with the business of Yovel. It's written Yovel, and of course this follows, you know, after it's written, you know, the various laws of the Yovel. Which include, first of all, the blowing of the shofar on Yom Kippur of the 50th year, and then after that we have two other things that are mentioned, namely that the slaves ought to go free. Well, how do we derive that? Because it's written across some draw of the Oros of Chol Yisrael, right? You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land of all its inhabitants. So obviously, to all the inhabitants mean all Hebrew slaves ought to go free at that time. Whether they've served the allotted number of years makes no difference. I mean, whether they have not served the allotted number of years that they're supposed to be in servitude, but automatically they're free as of that time. Okay?
Only say it doesn't apply to the Canaanite slaves.
Right, that's correct.
or Egyptian slaves?
Well, when we use the term Canaanite slaves, we mean any non-Jew.
Okay.
But, of course, with the laws of slavery that we learned in Kedushin, we learned that even so, the master is obligated. If he takes a non-Jewish slave, he's obligated to convert him or her. And they have the status, you know, in many respects, that they were required to observe all the mitzvahs of Sasa, including, for example, Shabbos. We're not allowed to work on Shabbos, okay? And
is that after the fourth convert?
Yeah. It's understood.
The fourth one?
It's the best thing to put it, sure. Because he's expected to do it. I mean, this was
the established practice. But I think what you're referring to is when you're forced to slave, when you're a slave,
he is your slave, he's bound to you.
Well, I could understand where a slave will have to obey, let's say, if you don't work on Shabbos, you know, eat carpets, all these things.
Correct.
But they, I mean, because they have to follow the master's orders, okay.
Yeah. Right.
But to convert completely to Judaism and have them believe in the way we do, there's kind of a...
I know. You're thinking in terms of liberalism.
No,
but the whole idea of slavery is not a liberal form.
No, it's not about liberalism.
The liberality...
It's about how people control man's mind, you know. If they're not of his own free will, to do 70 years.
Okay. I will guarantee, I agree with you, you cannot force a person's mind. But the fact of the matter is that for the slave, it's still to his advantage to be of the same faith and the same religion as his master or his mistress, you see.
If he wants to.
Yeah. But you say if he wants to, but I'm telling you that if you have an Evet Kanani, which, as I said, is a generic term for a non-Jewish slave, then in that case they have to be converted to Judaism. No, because their status is still not the same as of a pre-born Jewish slave who became a slave either through one of two ways. Okay?
Okay.
In Parsha Mishpatim, we have the case of slaves, Eved Ivri, right? These are pre-born Jews. They became slaves only by virtue of the fact that they had stolen. They had squandered whatever they had stolen, and they were unable financially to repay the person from whom they had stolen. Okay? In that case, you have the situation what we call Nimkar Bezdin. The Bezdin can impose as a sentence that he has to work the number of years in order to pay off what he had stolen and had not repaid. So that's one thing.
Does he have the status of a slave at that point?
At that slave, he is an Eved. He's an Eved Ivri. Okay? He's not an Eved Kanani. He's an Eved Ivri because he was born free. And of course, as we know, the Torah specifies that his wife, his children, they all have to be supported by the boss and everything else and so on. Okay? The other case is the one which is mentioned in Parsha Behar, towards the end of Sefer Vayikra. In Parsha Behar, we read about people who become financially destitute. And as a result, they decide that they'll sell their services as a slave. Because that way, they know that, you know, that all their needs will be taken care of during the time that they are slaves. Okay, now in either case, theoretically they're supposed to serve 6 years, or until such a time that they may be, well, I'm not talking about Yoru for a moment. It's another possibility, and of course that possibility is the fact that, let's say, their relative will pay off the debt that they had been incurred, or whatever it may be, right? And then they could be freed without having to serve, you know, for the full 6 years, okay?
Well, that's fine for the fellow that's full. How about the other one that was destitute?
No, the same thing. The same thing. Because he didn't steal anything, but he is expected, you know, we figure out how much, for example, let's say what his debt is, or something like that. You understand? Why did he sell himself?
Or he might be in debt.
Yeah, he's in debt. He borrowed, he wasn't able to repay, or something like that. But I don't say, you know, that the person to whom he owes can force him into slavery. No. But he can volunteer, you know, let's say, to serve as a slave in order to earn a certain amount of money that he gets, and that would help to repay the loan. But if the family can redeem him before him by paying it off, in that case, he can go free earlier than that time.
Well, let's take the next case where the fellow is destitute, but doesn't, is not in debt, but he realizes he's going to continue without money, he's going to be in debt, and he goes into this situation of slavery. So here, he has no situation as a legislator.
It would fall in the same category, however, as the second case, because he sold himself voluntarily, okay? And he sells himself for a certain amount of time. It doesn't have to be necessarily for 6 years. He could say, I'll sell my services for a year or 2 years or something like that.
And at the end of that time, he would get some lump sum?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because the Torah says specifically that, this if I'm already in Parsha Re'eh, that it's written over there, Hane Taniklo, right, that you have to give him a good send-off gift. In other words, you have to give him sheep and grain and you have to give him wine and stuff like that and so on, so that you have to treat him very, very handsomely. So this applies to the slave, right? So he's not sent forth in the community destitute. The boss, in recognition of the fact that he had his services all this time, so he has to give him this separation fee, whatever you want to call it, separation gift, okay? All right, so getting back then, Yovel, automatically Yovel will cancel out whatever remaining years there are on the contract. Whether it's Nimka Bestin, right, or whether it is, for Dorcas Hotspot, okay?
What does the person do who goes to debt? He doesn't get paid on those conditions.
To whom he owes the debt?
Yeah.
No, by virtue of the labor that he is. They estimate how much is the labor worth for the year.
But if he didn't serve his full term for retain the debt or the money that he's borrowed.
Because of yoga. All right, so he'll go free, but nevertheless, I mean, there's a moral obligation.
Have to absorb the law.
Okay, I understand, but there will be a moral obligation to repay. There would be that, okay? Look, we have the institution of Shemitah, right? 7th year. And Shemitah technically cancels out all debts. If you haven't been able to repay during the 6 years from the time of the loan, then automatically the beginning of the 7th year will cancel out the debt. This is according to the law of the Torah, right? Okay? So along comes the Gemara, and it says that even though this is the law, but nevertheless, if a person wants to take it, does not want to take advantage of the law because he knows that he's morally he still owes that money, then in that particular case the Ben Yishon would be very happy with this particular person if, in spite of the fact that he didn't have to repay it, he does repay it. So the same thing I would say would apply over here.
That's correct.
Right. Except that already Hillel, and this is 2,000 years ago, more, instituted something else. He instituted what they call the Prusbal, which means that if, because he saw that as the 7th year was approaching, people didn't want to lend because they figured, well, I'm going to lend the money and I'll never get it back, right? So this hindered everything. People couldn't get the loan. So as a result, he instituted the fact that if the lender, the borrower, they come to the Beis Din, then they write a note which means that which says that the money that has been borrowed is not borrowed from the lender, but instead it's borrowed from the court. You understand? So now he is obligated to repay the court, the Beis Din, which in turn is supposed to repay the other one.
That is not relieved by Yovel.
That would not be good.
Yeah, because this is already a commitment that you make, enforceable by the court.
Okay.
Does that mean that previous to that point, when we're coming back hundreds of years before they stopped lending also at that time? Or
it's quite possible. That's the reason why he felt that he had to do something in order to alleviate the situation. You know, don't forget, too, that lending money, you don't lend on interest. I mean, interest is strictly prohibited by the Torah. So you're lending money as a gemilas chesed. I mean,
belongs to that.
Right, exactly. You're performing a mitzvah. You're helping your fellow man. Okay. But, you know, people are not always so altruistic because when they figure that the money that they lend will never be repaid. Right. So, getting back then, Yovel, again, remember, blowing the shofar, the freeing of the slaves, and of course, the third thing is Shaften Ishal Akuzoso, the Yishal Mishpachto Toshif. In other words, you are to return to the original possession owned by your family and so on. So we have those three elements, okay? So what we found over here, beginning at the top of the page, is a difference of opinion. There is Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, which we find in the first three lines. I'll summarize it briefly. It says, what does it mean, Yovel He? What does it mean? It says, even though they did not, for example, cancel out, okay? In other words, even though they did not return the land, he says. This is what he means by Shomtev over here, because this is what we call Shmitas Karkos, all right? Even though they did not return the land to the original owner, and even though, he says, they didn't set the slaves free, right? But nevertheless, what is indispensable, according to Rabbi Yehuda? The answer is the setting free of the slaves, right? Whereas Rabbi Yossi, in his counter-argument, says that the Yovel He implies even though they did not send the land back to the original owners, even though they didn't set the slaves free, right? But what is indispensable in his opinion? What is indispensable in his opinion is the blowing of the shofar. That, he says, has to be carried out. And if there was no blowing of the shofar on Yom Kippur of the Yovel year, then it's nothing. It's not a Yovel. Okay, this is what he says. Okay, that's the Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi is compared to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda stresses the fact that you have to free the slaves. That's the indispensable element. Whereas Rabbi Yossi says the blowing of the shofar is what is indispensable. Right, and each one argues their point. Going down, let's say, to line 6 over there. I mean, we did it last week, but nevertheless, I want to review it again a little bit, okay? It says, "Bipnei ma ani omer Yovel He." Why do I say it is Yovel? Afal pi shelo sholchu, right? Even though they did not send the slaves free, right? V'ein Yovel, so he says, I say that it's not a jubilee, ela im kein toku, right? Unless they blew the shofar. Why? Because he says, the world can exist, he says, even if slaves were not set free. But it's impossible for the world that there shouldn't be tekiah shofar, the blowing of the shofar. Okay, in other words, everywhere you can blow shofar. People know all about it, but not everywhere do we find that people own slaves, and so therefore this is not necessarily indispensable. So therefore, according to Rabbi Yossi, as we say, the blowing of the shofar is the indispensable element in yoga, okay? And then he says, another dover achem, okay. I'll give you another reason, he says. Zu mesur al-beisdim, zu mesur al-beisdim. He says, the blowing of the shofar, this is an obligation which is entailed upon whom? Upon the Besdin. Whereas the freeing of slaves is not. Because not everybody has slaves. Right. This is up to the individual owner, right?
Right.
So now they ask, my Dover Acher, why does he add that Dover Acher? Other reason?
Sefachitay moy efshar de lekachal b'sefu elam de la mishaleach. You might say that it's impossible that there isn't one slave anywhere in the world who would not be set free. So maybe he says some place out in Australia or New Guinea or a place where, I mean, there might be a slave, therefore, and that slave would not be free. So that, therefore, I don't say that the freeing of the slaves is the indispensable element. What I do say is that the blowing of the shofar is. Why? Because Zum is Surah al-Bezdim, Zum is Surah al-Bezdim, right? One thing, blowing of the shofar, this is something that the Bezdin can enforce, and the other one, if it's someplace in Australia, how is the Bezdin in Eretz Yisrael going to enforce that? You understand? So this says Bishon of Rabbi Yossi, can you come our Tami? All right. And so we will just explain the reason of Rabbi Yossi. Ella Rabbi Yehuda, my Tami. What is Rabbi Yehuda's reason that he says that the indispensable element for Yovel is what? The freeing of the slaves. So he says, Omakra, because the Torah says, Okrosim Dror Boris, right? Because Sovar, and he's with the opinion, Mikra Nidrash, the Fonim Lov Nefonim. Go and take a look at the pasuk and see what is mentioned over there. Okay? So when we took a look at the Chumash, we see that there are different things mentioned. Okay? We find, for example, that the blowing of the shofar is mentioned first, right? And then Krosim Dor Boris Achol Yishrecha is there, right? And then Yovel Hi. So it says Yovel Hi. What do we find just in front of it? We find that it is Krosim Dor Boris Achol Yishrecha. Okay? So that, therefore, this is the indispensable element, according to Rabbi Yehuda. But we don't go back to the verse before, where they talk about blowing the shofar, and say that that is the indispensable thing. Nikra nirush lefon lov devon. So he says, the fully almor. So the Gemara says, everybody is in agreement that dror loshon chiras, that dror does imply freedom. Right, so my mashma, the Tanya Ein Dror El Lashon Chayrus. What is the meaning of mean? How do we, what do we learn from the fact that the Dror means is the language of freedom? So Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda said, Malashon Dror. What is the meaning of the word Dror? He says Dror. It comes from what? He says from the word Kimedayer Be Dayera. In other words, a person can live. It's like the word Dira, right? Person can live wherever he wants to live. Person is free to move and live wherever he wants to live. Not only that, but it's also Lovet Schorim Kol Medina. And a person is also free that he can bring Schorim, he can bring merchandise. In other words, he can do business wherever he wants to do business. This is the meaning of freedom. That you can live wherever you want, and you can go and do business wherever you want. So that's freedom. And therefore, when the Torah says, Akrosim Job Oretz, it means specifically that people have to be free from slavery in order that they may be able to choose wherever they want to live and to do business wherever they want to do business. Omer Rab Chiya Bar Abba, so Rab Chiya Bar Abba comes along and he says, Omer Rab Yochanan, and in the name of Rab Yochanan, he says, Zudivri Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi. Okay, so we've explained both Rabbi Yehuda's opinion and also Rabbi Yossi's opinion. Avol Chachomim, but as far as the sages are concerned, Chachamim Omrim Shloshton Mi'akvos Bo, that all three elements are indispensable. That if you omit any of them, then it is not jubilee. Okay, it's not yovel. Okay, Kosavre, because they are of the opinion that Nikra Nidrash Nifonov of Nifonov Ula Acharav, because they say when you have a verse in the Torah, you can interpret it not just with the immediate verse before, but even with the verse before it, and also what comes after it. Okay? So inasmuch, as we said before, that the Krosim Dror Ba'oretz, right, this came immediately before Yovel Hi, but what came prior to that? The blowing of the shofar, right? Ha'avatim Shofar Teruah. And what comes immediately after that? It's written, V'shatam Yishad Yerush HaSov Yishum Mishpachto, right? In other words, returning to the ancestral soul. And therefore, he says that all three elements are indispensable. Blowing of the shofar, freeing of the slaves, and finally, returning all the land, right, is what they meant when they said before Shomtim, right, okay. Kosavre, yeah, right, because they, the opinion that a verse can be interpreted before it and prior to that and afterwards. So now they come back and they say, V'hoksiv, isn't it written in the Torah, Yovel? It says the word Yovel, right? So he says, Hahu, in other words, if we say that everything is indispensable, right, all these three things, so then why does the word Yovel come, which would imply, why do we need it a second time? Second time would mean that maybe there's something that, something additional that we can learn, right? If we take a look in the Torah, okay? So we see that first of all they mention, you know, it's not count, right? Seven cycles of 7 years, right? Sheva Shab Shoshonim, Sheva Shoshonim, Sheva Pihomim, right? And then after that, Teshva Abrahim Yom, right, 49, Teshva Abrahim Shana, right, and then Havatim Shofa Trua Bakurish Hashmi, okay, and across them the Rorm, yeah, Yovel He, and so on, okay. So they have Yovel He, and then afterwards, again, they repeat the word Yovel He. Why do they have to repeat the word Yovel twice? So therefore, he says, we have another interpretation. What is it for? It says, Ahu da'afilu b'chutz ala'oretz. Very interesting point. That Yovel would apply even in lands outside of Eretz Israel. Very difficult to understand that. Okay? Because they immediately raise the following question, the Hoksiv, isn't it written b'oretz? Right? Cross them the road b'oretz. And normally in the Torah, when it says b'oretz, it normally means Eretz Israel. Okay? For example, the laws of Shviyas, right, the seventh year, not allowed to do. Does it apply to Chutz La'aretz? The answer is no, except that in the Mishnah we find that there are certain areas that were adjacent to Eretz Israel where Jews were living where they observed. Okay. But apart from those areas, any place else does not observe the seventh year, okay, the Shemitah. So, and then we have all kinds of mitzvos that we call mitzvos hatluyos ba'oretz. In other words, these are mitzvos which are completely dependent upon living in Eretz Yisrael in order to be able to fulfill them. Okay? Or, let's say, grown in Eretz Yisrael to be fulfilled. I'm thinking in terms of, for example, let's say, truma, right? Meiser, these are completely dependent upon Eretz Israel. Anything, for example, which is grown outside of Eretz Israel is not subject to tithing. It's not subject to truma, okay? It's not subject to these
things.
How
about cattle and things like that?
How about what?
Cattle.
Cattle. Also, I mean, as long as there was a Beis HaMikdosh, where it was permissible to sacrifice a Bechor, right? A firstborn animal born that particular year,
yeah,
as we've spoken about lots of times, right?
But you have to tithe, you got to give every tenth, don't you have to give every tenth?
Or the Meiser, it's the same thing. I mean, the Bechor goes to the Kohen. Meiser is actually eaten by the person who owns it, just that he's required to go to Yerushalayim and to make a festive meal over there and eat the Meiser. Okay, so there's a slight difference, you know, between the two, but the point is they're all dependent upon the existence of the Beis HaMikdash. If we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, then we can't carry that out, except that the Bechor has a special sanctity, even as we said, because that's in a different section in the Torah, and therefore if a firstborn animal is born, then in that case you're not allowed to plow with him, not allowed to shear it if it's a sheep or anything like that, okay? And the only thing you can do is you wait for a mum, a blemish to develop, and then a kohen can eat it, okay? Can shecht it and eat it.
Then the kohen can eat it.
Right, yeah. Then the kohen eats it, right? Because the bechor goes to the kohen, we said that, okay? Sam, you don't know what you're missing as a kohen.
Now, if we through Mamaisa, we have to observe Chutz La'aretz if it came from Eretz Yisrael to us.
Absolutely right, Stan. This is already a different problem, that fruits and vegetables that come to us from Eretz Yisrael, we have to know that Trumas and Maisers and so on were taken from them, and also that they were not grown in Shvius. They were not grown in the seventh year. So that is true.
To be sure, should we do something about it anyway when we have it in our possession?
Well, this is a very good problem. I mean, what do we do? In case of doubt, of course, you're permitted to simply take it and, you know, take a little piece of it and simply bury it or something like that. So, there's nothing much you can do. Yes. Many canned goods, for example, you see already, packaged goods will have on them the statement that Tumas, Masrus, Tevel, I mean, all these things were taken from them before. Yeah. Yes, Beverly.
I was told when we were in Israel that the large supermarket chain had certificates that Tumas had been taken.
Many of them.
Okay, but if we bought something in the shoe, we were not supposed to consider that having been done.
That's correct, unless they have a certificate.
Unless they have
a
certificate.
Right.
So my guy wouldn't consider the certificate.
Right. That's correct.
That's only if it was bought from a Jew. If it was bought from an Arab.
If it's bought from an Arab, then that's not.
Doesn't make a difference.
That's correct. Absolutely right.
How do I know what?
Yeah, right. Bought from an Arab or grown by an Arab, then you don't have to. That's correct. Yeah. Would be probably Misrata Datot. Yeah, I would think so. But also, you know, you have in every town, you have, a special vod for that and so on. So they should take care of it. I know that in Yerushalayim, you come to various areas over there, and then you'll see the Uda over there, you know, that they took from his maizmas, etc., right? So if you have a very reliable person, you know, whom you can trust, you know, in some cases, they do it automatically. They try to go, for example, let's say Tanuda, which is the biggest marketing concern in Eretz Yisrael. You know, it's like a collective. A cooperative. They buy up from the farms the various things, whether it's milk and cheese and so on and so forth, or whether it's fruit products, vegetables and so on, and then they sell to the various markets. So some of them have a reputation that they have Rabbonim who take care of this. So you have to know who you buy from if you don't want to violate the law.
Or raise it yourself.
Well, if you raise it yourself, fine, but you still have to take Trumas and Maasrus if you're living in Eretz Yisrael. Right? Of course, a way to not to be subject is, you know, the whole business of hydroponics, where we find, you know, that it's not actually being grown in the soil, it's grown instead, raised from the soil, right? So under those circumstances, then that could be used, and this became a big industry in Eretz Yisrael.
How about the other alternative, that whatever they're producing is not involving the Jewish community? Period.
Well, that's all. Sylvia? Hi. Yeah, I have the package for you.
Copy.
You see the bag behind me?
Yes.
Good. That's it. Thank you very much.
We don't know about that. Yeah. Supervised. Yeah. Soil was the same thing, right? No, in a hothouse, it's fine. Oh, in a hothouse, yeah. So this hothouse would be the same thing like it's growing in the field.
No.
No?
Oh, in a hothouse?
I'm talking about a
hydroponic
house. Not hydroponic, in a hothouse.
And a greenhouse.
That's
already is a different problem, right? Because if you use soil from Eretz Yisrael and you grow it, and you grow in it, even though it's in a hothouse, then in that case it would be subject, right? That's correct. Gemara speaks about, you know, a flower pot, but it's the same idea, right?
But the soil is from out of the
land. So you're going to start in to take soil from outside of Israel and bring it there as well? No, they don't do that. Okay.
That's not feasible.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, now to get on with the text over here. Okay. So now we see that there is one opinion, however, which says that Yovel is applicable even in Chutz La'aretz, okay, even outside of Eretz Yisrael, in spite of the fact that the Pasuk says Ba'aretz, right? So he says, we can interpret that as follows. He says, Ahu, he says, we are to understand this, Bizman Shenoheg Dro Ba'aretz, Noheg Bechutz La'aretz, okay. At a time when all the slaves are freed in Eretz Yisrael, then in that case, all slaves outside of Israel also have to be freed.
Outside.
Yeah, that's what he says. But Bisman Shay, you know Higbaritz, but at a time when the freeing of slaves is no longer observed in Eretz Israel, then that case in that case is not observed either in the diaspora in Chutzlaretz. Okay. That's what he says. Okay. Historically, of course, Jews did own slaves. They did, yeah. Hello, Greg, how are you? Good evening. They did own slaves, you know, up to a point where they no longer did it. But even in medieval times, there were Jewish owners, you know, who did have non-Jewish slaves, okay? The slavery business was a recognized business back in those days. So
level, what you said was true.
Right.
That they had to convert them. They no longer they were Jews.
You're right. You're right. But you know how
they
these
don't
laws
free,
would
though.
Affect. You see,
they don't go free.
Slaves and Chutz La'aretz obviously. I mean, because we don't have the freeing of slaves on Eretz Yisrael, so we don't have it now. So this is more a matter of theory. And certainly, it's not a practical. Right. Okay. Now we come back again to the problem of planting in Shavuos. Lanatia. We said in the Mishnah that Rosh Hashanah, right, the first of Tishrei, is also a time, is a Rosh Hashanah, right? The first of Tishrei is a Rosh Hashanah for also planting. Nitya. Okay?
Yeah.
So he says, Benalon, how do we know this? He says, Dirsir, the Pasuk says, Shalosh Shanim Arelim. First of all, we have the fact that if you have a tree and it grows fruit during the first 3 years of its growth, then in that particular case, you're not allowed to use the fruit.
Okay.
Literally, it's the fruit is called Arelim. In other words, it's those who are uncircumcised, right? Not allowed to use it, okay?
Do you give it to Goyim, though?
Question is whether you're allowed to have hanor from it. Well, it might be one way to dispose of it, but certainly a Jew can't have any any hanor. He's not allowed to eat it or have any hanor from it.
Can it be given to animals?
That would be hanor, because if it's your animals, you're getting hanor from it.
No.
Because you're giving them a set of feed.
Give it to strange animals, or wild animals.
That's what I say, give it to Goyim.
As a matter of fact, even in Yerushalayim today, they sometimes give some of these things to the, they bring it down to the zoo, and let the animals eat over there. Okay, so that's what we mean by orlo, when we speak about it, that fruit of the first 3 years. Uksiv, and then we have another pasuk which deals with uvashanor of the yeast in the fourth year. This already is a different story. Actually it's the same thing, but it says, right, when are you allowed to eat of the orla, right, in the fourth year, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is one thing, and it says the yalif shana shana v'tishrei, and it says we can learn that. How do we know that it's the first of Tishrei and not, let's say, the first of Nisan, which is also called a Rosh Hashanah, as we learned in the Mishnah, right? So he says, because we learn it through a comparison of verses, what we call a Gezeirah Shavah. Okay. It's written in the case of Tishrei, a pasuk that we already alluded to before. It's written about Eretz Yisrael that, you know, that God's eyes, Eina Hashem Lekecha Bo, right? That the Rebbeinu Shalom always looks out for Eretz Yisrael. What? May Reishis Hashono V'yad Achrishono, right? From the beginning of the year until the very end of the year. And we interpret that that verse is referring to Rosh Hashanah, as I've already mentioned several times, right? So, therefore, that's proof positive, what? That for things that are planted, in order to know the age of it, you should go from, use Rosh Hashanah as the date, right? This is what we've established. So now they say, how do you know that? How do you know that? The Ligmar Shana Shana Min Nisan. Look, the word Shana is also found in connection with Rosh Chodesh Nisan. You remember back in Exodus, what does it say? Achorish Chazeh Lochem Rosh Chodoshim, right? Rishon Hu Lochem Lochodshe Hashana, right? It's to be the first of the months of the year. So the word Shana is also there, right? So why can't we learn and say that it's not the first of Tishrei, which is the determining factor for counting the age of a tree, but rather what? The first of Nisan, right? Dichsiv, as we said before, Rishon Hu Lachem Lachodshe Hashana. So the answer is, Donin Shana She'eni Mochadoshim. We have to compare for our Gezeirah Shava, where it's written the word Shana, year, and the word Chodesh is not connected with it, because Bereishis Hashanah Yad Achri Shana, do you find the word Chodesh over there? No. Okay? So that is closer to what we find over here, to what? To Shalosh Shanim, right? Harelim, and Uvashano Horavis, you see. So it's closest to it. So that is a valid comparison, he says. The ain't done in Shana, but you don't draw your comparison from a year. She'ain imo chadosha. Let's skip some Shana. Don in Shana, imo chadosha, Shana, Shana, imo chadosha. Right. Where it's not mentioned. But the ain't done in Shana, she'ain imo chadosha, Shana, she'ain imo chadosha. But we do not take the reference to the Bashana Horadis, where the word chodosh is not mentioned. Or Shalosh Shanim, right? It's not mentioned at all over there. And compare it to a verse wherein the word Shana is combined together with what? With Chodesh, with Chodeshim. So, therefore, the first one is a more valid comparison, and therefore it means that the date has to be what? The first of Tishrei. So, here we start in on a very difficult business over here. I'll go down to the bottom of the page, and we'll call it a night, and then next week, and yes, Hashem, we'll start on the top of the Yud.
Okay. The last three lines?
Yeah, the last four lines over here, okay? Tanu Rabbana. Okay, our sages thought as follows. He says, Echad Hanoteya, Echad Hamavrich, the Echad Hamarkiv, Erev Shavis, Shloshim Yom Zdei Rosh Hashanah, also Losh Shana, Umutal Akaiman Bashvis. Very important point over here. We said a moment ago that Rosh Hashanah, right, marks the beginning of the year as far as whatever activity happens with trees. Okay? What we said. Of course, later on we also have another Rosh Hashanah for trees, and that is, if you remember, either according to Beis Shammai, the first day of Shvat, or according to Beis Hillel, Chamishasa B'Shvat, the 15th, right? But here we're talking about trying to determine the age of a tree. Okay? Trying to determine the age of a tree. So, we say that it makes no difference. We have a law in Shvi'is that not allowed to do any agricultural labor, right? We know that. Okay. Land has to lie fallow, not allowed to do any agricultural labor during Shvi'is, during the seventh year. Okay. So, the Baraisa over here says it makes no difference whether you are noteya, whether you're planting a tree, or mavrich. Mavrich means, it's related to the word berach. What is berach? Berach means a knee, right? So mavrich means that you take a branch and you put it into the ground. Particularly this is done with a vine, that you take a vine which is connected, you put it into the ground, and eventually it's going to grow another thing. You know, they had different agricultural skills, okay? That's the mabech. The echad ha-markiv. Markiv means that you graft one branch onto another branch. And there are different ways of doing
drafting.
It. Drafting, right. Like you make a cut in a branch and then insert another branch in it, and you know, that would make the tree more fruitful or something like that. Well, all these agricultural labors are prohibited. When are they prohibited? So the answer is, you know, before the beginning even of the Shviyas, before the beginning of the seventh year, they were already prohibited Shloshim Yom Lifnei Rosh Hashanah. Actually, what it means is that if you had it in the ground 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah, then in that case we say also Lo Shana, then it counts as a year, even though only 30 days have passed. Ubuto Lekayimah Mishviyas, and you're permitted to keep these trees or these plants, whatever you want to say, okay, you're permitted to keep them and not to destroy them. Pachos b'shloshim shana, pachos b'shloshim yom, excuse me, but if it is less than 30 days lifnei Rosh Hashanah, prior to Rosh Hashanah, lo yotza lo shana, then A, you cannot count it as a year, and secondly, v'yotza l'kayimim b'shviyas, and you're not allowed to permit these to remain in existence even during Shviyas. In other words, what is the farmer expected to do? He's expected to tear them out so that he can't use it. Just as, for example, in the case of kilayim, in other words, where you have a mixture of one plant right within another plant and so on and so forth, without making separations between them, also that has to be destroyed. So this is where we'll stop at this particular point. Okay, so we see already that even though Rosh Hashanah is the date, yet in reality, what do we find? That Shviyas already technically begins. We are currently on Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yud, Omid Aleph. And we are continuing from where we left off last week with the conclusion of Tes Omid Beis. Okay. So, we have already discussed the fact that as far as the, you know, that the tree, right, or the plant, whatever it may be, it has to be in the ground. Here we're talking about the trees primarily, but still it could be other things, okay? It has to be in the ground 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah if we want to be able to count that year as a year towards Orla. That's the idea. Count it as a year towards Orla. Okay? Okay. Or towards Revai. So now the Gemara continues and it says, but not so fast. It doesn't mean that automatically, as soon as the Rosh Hashanah, let's say, of the fourth year.
Did you put it on the Nisim?
No.
The microphone?
Well, I don't want to put it on the Gemara.
On the Nisim.
Yeah, okay. my throat is still not but okay. It does not mean that, therefore, as soon as another Rosh Hashanah comes, automatically we're permitted to begin using the fruit, because now the Gemara adds something else. It says, "Operos natiyazu asurin atu bishvat imli orla orla v'im revai revai." Okay, which means simply that the fruit of this particular tree that has been planted still cannot be used. They are osur. They are prohibited for use until tu bishvat of the following year, whether it is for Orla or whether it's for Revai. No. We're counting trees, right? We're counting years right now. Okay. We started out by saying
the first year, okay.
Right. Okay. We started out by saying that if it was on the ground 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah, so that counts as year one. Then you have year two. Then you have year three, alright, and then, so that takes care of Orla. So does it mean therefore that when Rosh Hashanah comes of the fourth year,
you are
permitted to eat it? The answer is no. You have to wait till Tu B'Shvat of that year before you're permitted to, let's say, take it to Yerushalayim, right? And the same thing would be true as far as when does the fruit become free, I mean, of any question, that there's no Orla, no Revai, nothing, you know, connected with it, but you could, you know, use that fruit. But it still is when? Tu B'Shvat of the fifth year. So the question is, what is it based on? So Menohanim Bile, what is the source of this particular idea? That is, where do we find in the Torah a reference to this? So Rabbi Barabo, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, so Rabbi Barabo said the name Rabbi Yochanan, Umotubo, and there are those who ascribe it rather Mishmei, the Rabbi Yanai, in the name of Rabbi Yanai, and they say the Pasuk is as follows. Omar Kroy said that this is the Pasuk. It's written, Uvashano Horviyis, Uvashano Hachamishis. Now, we are, of course, this is a reference, you know, where we find the reference, you know, to the fact that Shalosh Shanim Yu'arelim, right, that for 3 years the fruit is to be considered like uncircumcised, literally, in other words, not allowed to eat them, not allowed to enjoy them, right? And then Uvashanohar of the yeast, right, then it says, yeah, Kodesh Yulim Hashem, this becomes holy, and you can rejoice before Hashem. So what does it mean? Hilulim Hashem. So it means that you have to take them to Yerushalayim in the Beis Hamikdash, and there rejoice over there, and, you know, and enjoy the fruit and so on. And then Uvashanohar Hamishis, you know, beginning in the 50th, then everything is okay. I mean, so if the Torah says, and in the 4th year, and in the 5th year, there must be a reason. Now, what is the reason? So this is how he darshans. This is how he explains the psukim. Really, a 2 psukim, but it's, yeah. Says, Pe'omim, there are times he says, Sheboravis, that it may taka be the 4th year, right? Va'adayin asura, mishumorla. And at the same time, they are still prohibited because of the prohibition against Orla, even though it's already the 4th year, but still, it counts as if, you know, the prohibition of the 3rd year is still in effect, right? Upalmim, and there are also times it says, Shabachamishis, it's already the 5th year, but the fruits are still prohibited because of the law of Revai. So, in other words, what is the conclusion? The conclusion is what we had at the top of the page. Namely, you have to go, not beginning with Rosh Hashanah, but you have to wait until Tu B'Shvat of the year before it finally becomes available. Okay? So, now the Gemara poses a new question. It says, Lema, are we to say, the Lo Kerabi Meir, that this Baraisa that we had, about that you have to wait until Tu B'Shvat, it does not follow either the opinion of Rabbi Meir. It doesn't follow the opinion of Rabbi Meir. This is a statement, first of all. The E Rabbi Meir, because if it were Rabbi Meir, Go Omar, didn't he say, Yom Echad Bashona Choshev Shona, that one day in the year is counted as a year? Now, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is what? What we learned at the very beginning of the Masechta, right. Namely, as far as kings are concerned, right? What do we say about kings? That if it's a, you know, Malchus Yisrael, Jewish king, right? That he began his reign even the 29th day of Adar, right? Then automatically that counted for a year. All right. But actually, here they're referring to another statement that Rabbi Meir made, where he again makes the same point. The Tanya, as we have learned, Parho Amor Batorah Stam Ben Esrim Yagor Chodesh V'Yom Echad Divrei Rabbi Meir. Okay. In the Torah, we are told, of course, that different sacrifices, you know, require different types of animals, right? We have Egel, we have Par, and we have Par Ben Bokar. The question is, are these all synonyms for each other, even though it's the same type of an animal, or are they different? All right, we always translate the word egel as what? As a calf, right? But how do you translate par ben bakor, an ox, the son of cattle? It's a very difficult phrase to translate, right? All right, par we know, par is a bull. All right, bull we can understand. So, as we're going to see, actually, they do make a distinction. So, a little patience, and another couple of minutes, we'll find out why does the Torah use 3 different expressions, okay? All right. So at any rate, the first one is the definition given by Rabbi Meir. And what did he say? He said that what is a par? He says that a par, in other words, a bull without any other thing, stam means it doesn't say ben bokar, in other words, you understand? In other words, it doesn't add that phrase. So it just says par, parim shuvel, mishnayim, whatever it may be, and so on, parechod, ayalechod, whatever it may say. So it simply uses the word par, then par implies that the animal, the bull, has to be at least 24 months and one day old. In other words, how old?
2 years.
2 years and a day, right? Once the animal has entered into the third year of its existence, even if it's only for the first day, it is now in the category of being a par. So in other words, here the stress given by Rabbi Meir is that the fact that what? Again, Yom Echad, correct? One day, which you add to it, it's already counts as if it were a complete year. You see, this is what he's trying to say. Rabbi Elazar disagrees with Rabbi Meir, naturally. So he says, Ben Esrim Yarbor Chodesh Melamed Yom. All right? He says that, no, a par has to be not simply 2 years and a day, but it has to be 2 years and 30 days. Okay? Shehoyah Rabbi Meir Omer. So they continue with the discussion. They say, Rabbi Meir used to say, Kol Mokim Shenemar Egel Batorah Stam Ben Shona. Wherever the Torah simply mentions Egel and doesn't have anything else qualifying it, right? Then in that particular case, Egel means that it's an animal within its first year of life, what we call a calf.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. Ben Bokar, when the Torah used the expression Ben Bokar, so it says that means Ben Shtayim. It means it's an animal that's already 2 years old. Okay? Par, this is Ben Shalosh. A bull, it means that it has to be 3 years old. Okay? And of course, if it's Rabbi Meir's opinion, we already said what? That actually it has to be 2 years plus at least one day. Okay. So the Gemara says, I feel the tamer Rabbi Meir. All right, let's say we agree with Rabbi Meir. Ki koma Rabbi Meir, but when Rabbi Meir said, Yom Echad Bashono Choshev Shono, that one day in the year can be considered as if it were a year, you know when?
Misav Shono.
It's Misav Shono, right. That's at the end of a year. In other words, you've had a sequence of years. You've had, let's say, 2 full years, and then comes along the beginning of another year, but we're talking about the fact that it has to be following 2 full years. But you don't do it in reference to, let's say, here's one day prior to Rosh Hashanah, right? And then you say, okay, Rosh Hashanah is here, that's not the beginning of a second year. It won't work that way, okay? This is how he explains Rabbi Meir. I should put a period like after the word low, alright? But beginning of the year, no. I mean, don't forget, in the Gemara, there's no periods, no commas, you have to figure it out by yourself how the lashon goes, okay? Alright, now, Omar Rava, Rava says, the law of Kalvachemahu says, you know, you might think that you could figure this out by logical reasoning, but he says not necessarily so. What would be the logical reasoning? The logical reasoning, he says, is as follows. Uman nida she'ein techilas hayoim eilelo, but the seif hayoim eilelo mitchiloso, okay. Question that we have over here is a woman who has her period. Okay? Alright. So, the question is, we know that by law she has to count 7 days. Originally from the Torah, this is what she was required to do. Then, as time went on, Noshim Hechmir al-Latzbon, I mean, the women decided that they wanted to be more machmir than what the Torah was. And so therefore, they count first, you know, let's say at least 5 days. Necessarily, they can count more than that because it depends upon whether they see any blood, right? And then after that, then they first begin to count the Shiva Nikim. They begin to count the 7 clean days. Okay. All right. Now, let's take the 7th day of a clean day. It should be, all right? Well, let's take it the other way around. It's the last day when she sees blood. Assuming that she sees blood in the morning, right? So, but then, that would be Tchilosa, right? Right. If she sees blood in the morning, then this day cannot count as a clean day. But the sofa, if she checks herself at the end of the day and she sees that she is clean, there's no more an issue, then right? Then the end of the day can be counted. Alright? So far what do we see? We see that the beginning doesn't count, but what counts? At the end of a series, it counts, okay? So, therefore, he's trying to work it out logically, right? So, in that case, bitchiloso, shono sheyom echot elelo, b'seifo, oh, I have to give you another sheet. Next sheet. Okay, sorry. Yeah, Einodin, here we are. All right, let's give out the Einodin. Einodin is always the conclusion. If it's so, Ma, it always begins with Ma, you know, and if so and so forth, then Einodin, isn't it logical to assume what? That?
It is not logical.
Huh? No. But Einodin, it's really, it's a question. Isn't it logical, right? Isn't it logical? You understand? Is it not logical? Is it not logical, right? Okay. Is it not logical, he says, Sheyom echad eile betchilasa, right? That one day should count if it is at the very beginning. So, needless to say, it's a contradiction of what? Of Rabbi Meir, what he said before, that he says one day. One day is all right, but the question is one day at what particular point? Right, at the end it counts, but at the beginning, not. So you can't argue logically that what? That the first day already counts as a whole year. This is what he's trying to say. All right. The LMI. So, in that case, all right, let's say, all right, so we've already established what? That in the case of Rabbi Meir, he is of the opinion that how many days before Rosh Hashanah can we count for a year? So we said we can count what? One day, right? But is it one day before Rosh Hashanah? Or is it one day after the conclusion of 3 years, of 4 years? You understand? This is the question where the one day comes in, according to him. If we say it's at the end, by the way, it would be a contradiction to the Baraisa, which speaks that they have to do what? That you have to wait till Tu Bishvat that year, okay? But so the din, incidentally, according to the Rambam, is talking that you have to wait till Tu Bishvat. The Rambam agrees with that, okay? Yeah. But at any rate, we're trying to work out the logic over here, okay? But if we say that he's of the opinion that one day just prior already counts as a year, all right, so that's Rabbi Meir's opinion. At any rate, it would not work out either then if we say that there should be a much longer period prior to Shavuos, right? Prior to Shavuos, in order to say that, you know, the, let's say that the tree can be counted that it has fulfilled a year when Rosh Hashanah comes. Because what did we say before? We said it had to be Shloshim Yom, had to be 30 days. So as we can see, there's a great deal of difficulty over here in the Gemara in trying to understand exactly what the situation is. So, Rabbi Elazar, my Rabbi Elazar, Vela my Rabbi Elazar. So, how about Rabbi Elazar? All right, let's get back to his opinion. He says, as far as he's concerned, then Shloshim is Shloshim Boy. He says, it's not that you need 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah for the tree to be planted, you know, where you say that it counts as 1 year, but actually you need 30 plus 30. In other words, you need 60 days prior to Rosh Hashanah. Ditnan, as we've learned in the Mishnah, it says, Ein notin, we do not plan for you, mavrichin, nor do we use, you know, what we learned before, mavrichin, that you bend it over into the ground in order that it should form a new plant, or v'yein markivin, you're not allowed to graft, erev shaviz, pochos melamed yom lefnei Rosh Hashanah, right? 30 days before Rosh Hashanah. This is what the Mishnah said that we learned. But v'yim nota, v'hivra, v'hirkiv, yakor. So he has to, if he did prior to that, then they have to destroy it. So, but the question is, where over here, this is what I don't understand, where does it say 30 and 30? Right, okay. So we have to say that this is his shita, that's all he believes that, that's all, okay? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda has a different interpretation. It says, Kol harkovo, any kind of grafting, she'eino keiletes begimul yomim, if it doesn't take hold within a 3 day period, shuveino keiletes, then we have to say that it will no longer be effective. It will, it has no effect, whatever. Okay. So, in other words, for him, what would we have to say? We would have to say then that you need how many days? You need at least 3 days prior. Right, 3 days plus the 30. Okay. Because you don't know whether on the 30th day, if you planted before Rosh Hashanah. In other words, let's say, what would be 30 days before Rosh Hashanah? The answer is, it would be like the 30th day of the month of Av. Okay? Because how much does Elul have? Elul has only 29 days. Yeah. So, would they, let's say that they planted on the 30th day.
You don't get a month plus 3 days.
Oh, hold it. Okay. So, let's understand that. Okay? All right. Let's say. Okay. Yeah.
So you mentioned Elul is 29 days. By 30 days, does it mean actually 30 days or a month, whichever the month may be?
Well, okay. It says specifically Shloshim Yom.
Well, then Elul, in order to cover Shloshim Yom, must include 30 days of Av without the extra 30 days.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Hold it. So, Stam the Mishnah, in other words, without adding anything to it, the Mishnah itself says what? 30 days. So 30 days would be, let's say, the 30th day of the month of Av, which is exactly 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah, correct? Okay. So technically you plant it on that day. According to the Mishnah, it's in the ground long enough in order to be able to be counted as a year when Rosh Hashanah comes, correct? You follow me so far? All right. Now, along comes Rabbi Yehuda, and he says, not so fast. Right? Because he says, that if it doesn't take hold within 3 days, then it doesn't count. So in other words, he needs a minimum of 3 days
before
in order to, in order to take hold, so that we know that it's really, it's rooted in, or something like that, whatever you want to say, okay? So in that case, then you have to go back 3 days before that, okay?
On the 30 days,
yeah,
for the purpose of taking hold?
So it's 30 plus another 3, so it makes it already 33 days before.
But isn't the purpose of the 30 days to indicate of the 30 days that it should take hold? So why do we need another 3 days?
Because he says, even if we plant 30 days before, we have no assurance that it will take hold. That's why he says you need an extra margin. Need an extra margin.
Okay? So if you need an extra margin, what is the extra margin? Because to him, it's 3 days. Right, right. Okay, so you need another 3 days. Okay. Yeah. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Shimon, Omrim, they say, Shtei Shabbosais. Actually, it takes longer to determine whether it's really going to take effect. You need 2 weeks for it. So if that's the case, then how many more days are we now adding? Not adding just three, we're now adding another 14 days. You understand? Okay. V'yom Rav Nachman, v'yom Rav Abu. And so Rav Nachman said, in the name of Rav Abu, he said, Divrei ha'omer lamed, right? In the opinion of those who say that it has to be 30 days, Zorich lamed, right? Ushloshim. He says, you know, when it says that you need 30 days, you know what? He's really of the opinion that he needs 30 days plus 30 days prior before. Okay? That makes it already what? 60 days. Right. In other words, don't take it literally as 30 days. You have to do 30 days, but we don't know because it will require another 30 days prior in order to make sure that it's really going to work. Yeah. Right? So that now the 30 plus 30 gives us now 60 days. When it comes to the one who says that, you know, it takes 3 days for it to take hold, then you need 33 days. The divrei ha'omer be'shabosais, according to the one who's of the opinion that it requires 2 weeks, so you need 30 days and 2 more weeks. V'inami, and likewise, Rabbi Yehuda sovale. And likewise, when he's in the same opinion as Rabbi Yehuda, who said that, you know, you have to always, you know, require at least, right, Gimel, right, to require at least 33 days to make sure that it is. So he says, a Shloshim boy. In other words, it's Gimel the Shloshim boy. He needs 33 days. So, that getting back, so the question is, why did the Mishnah itself say 30 days? So he says, El Eliyolam, but getting back, we have to come to the opinion that Rabbi Meir, that's really Rabbi Meir's opinion, the Chikom Alamed Liklita, right? So, and what he's trying to say is that it requires how many days for it to take hold? It requires 30 days. So he is actually the minimum that it requires. So he, Hachi, so if that's the case, the Gemara now says, didn't we say the Rabbi Meir said that Yom Echad, right? Choshev Kishana, right? One day. So in that case, it says, if that's the case, Lamed Aleph Boy, right? Then it should not have said in the Mishnah 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah, but it should have said what? 31 days prior to Rosh Hashanah. So the answer is, Kosovar, well, he was of the opinion that what? That Yom Lamed Oyle Lekahan Ulechan, that the 30th day can be counted either as the number one or beginning of 30, right? In other words, like, let's say, divide the day into half, right? So the first part of the day, I'm only saying, you know, figuratively, right? The first part of the day is that one day prior, right? And then the rest of the day counts as the beginning of the 30-day period. So in other words, that's why you only require 30 days, because in reality, it already takes in other words, the one day that I said, Chosh of Kishana. Okay. Omer Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan comes along and he says, Ushnehen Mikra Echodoshu. He says, actually, both of them, even with all the disagreements, they're all interpreting the same pasuk in the Torah. What does it say? So if you remember, it's written concerning the model, you know, the flood in the days of Noach, right? It says over there, Vayehi, and it came to pass, Be'achas v'sheish me'os shana, in the 601st year, right? Borishon, on the first day, or right? In the first month. Of course, after that says Be'echad L'Chodesh on the first day of the month. So the question is, how do you understand the pasuk? Rabbi Meir Sovar, Rabbi Meir was of the opinion, Mida'akate Yoim Echad Hu Da'ayil B'Shono. Right? Inasmuch as it says, if you remember, it says Be'echad L'Chodesh, right? The first day of the month. And yet it counts already as the beginning of what? Sheish Meyos. Achatz b'sheish mayos, right? The 601st. Okay? So in other words, this shows us what? That Yom Echad already counts, right? Yom Echad hu the ayil b'shona, the kalkori le'shona, and they called it the year. So Shema Mino, from this we see that Yom Echad b'shona choshev shona. That even one day in the year can be considered as being a year, based on this interpretation of the pasuk by Rabbi Meir. The Edoch, and how about the other authority? Right? Rabbi Elazar. Okay. So he says, no, he bases on a different idea. Takes the same pasuk, he says, Iksiv, if the Torah had said, B'sheish meyos b'achas shana, then the 601st year, Kiddukamra, then you're right. In other words, that it's beginning, you know, Borishon Echad Bachodesh already means that, okay, it's the beginning of a new year. But Hashta, now, however, let's take a look how the Pasuk is written. Dirsiv, it's written Be'achas, right, in one, V'sheish Meyos Shana, right, and 600 years. So he says, Shana, the word Shana, he says, Ashesh Meyos Kai. That's in reference to the word Sheish Meyos. My Achas. So what do we mean by one? So it says, Aschalto de Achas Kamar. All that we're doing is to say that this is the beginning of the 601st year, and it doesn't mean that, therefore, one day is already a year. Okay? The Rabbi Elazar my Tamo Dichsiv Barishon Be'echad L'Chodesh, and so all right, Rabbi Elazar. So what do you do with some more words in the pasuk where it's written on the first month, of course, on the first day of the month, right? It says Mitakati Yom Echad Hu the Ayel B'Chodesh, the Kolkori L'Chodesh. Okay, so it says inasmuch as it's written over there, there's one day, and it's at the beginning of the month starts over there, and yet he calls it Chodesh, so he says Shema Mino, from this we learn what? That Yom Echad B'Chodesh Choshev Chodesh, that one day in the month already can be considered as being a full month. Okay, so they say no, Umid Yom Echad B'Chodesh Choshev Chodesh. Now, alright, so granted then that we say that one day in the month already counts as if it were a month, right? So Lamed Yom B'Shona Chashuvim Shona, then in that case we should say that 30 days in a year already counts as a whole year, right? The Chodesh L'Minuyov, and the month has to make it's counted by what? By the number of days in it. V'Shona L'Minuyov, and the year is counted by what? By the number of months that there is to it. Alright, so now we come to a new inyan over here, and I think I better give out the next sheet of paper because we're going to go right into it. So here comes the next sheet. I didn't want to pass it out. Yeah. Author. All right, I'm skipping what's in the parenthesis because it's not really relevant at the moment to what we have over here. And we go into a new inyan over here. Famous machlokas that we have between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. Tanya, we've learned a teaching where it says, Rabbi Eliezer, Omer, Rabbi Eliezer says, B'tishrei nivra ho'olam, right? Says, the world was created in the month of Tishrei, But Tishrei Nolda Avos, and Tishrei, the fathers of our people were born. But Tishrei Mesu Avos, and Tishrei, our fathers died. But Pesach Nolad Yitzchak. I have to tell you, by the way, there's something that's not quite right over there, because it's a slight contradiction to what it said over there.
Almost.
The Tishrei Nolda Avos, right? Right, right. He's also. But, okay. Sometimes we have what we call Shikiras Haloshen, which means that you use a language and automatically you sort of pick up a phrase without being too exact as to what it is, you see. Just the force of habit of the language, okay? All right, because according to him, he says the Pesach Nolad Yitzchak, that Yitzchak was born on Pesach, okay? The Rosh Hashanah, huh? I will come back to that. The Rosh Hashanah Nifkedo Sora, Rachel Vachana, and Rosh Hashanah, three Akoros, right? Three women who were barren, had been unable to bear children. They were remembered by the Rabbeinu Shalom, said that they were able to conceive and to bear children. Naturally, who were they? Sarah, Rachel, and Chano, right? And the Rosh Hashanah, Yotze Yosef, the Beis Wasurin. It was on Rosh Hashanah that Yosef was freed from prison. And the Rosh Hashanah, Batla Avoda Mi Avoseinu Mitzrayim. And it was on Rosh Hashanah that the labor that our ancestors had to perform in Egypt ceased at that particular time. And Rosh Hashanah came in the year of the redemption.
How does it tie in the Rosh Hashanah?
Yeah.
Left the Zohar.
Yeah, right, right.
And right after the Malach went, right after the Malach went to Sodom,
right.
And the Lord overmats us. How's it tie in?
Number one, first of all, I agree with you that there is a discrepancy.
Yeah.
Okay? There is a discrepancy. There's another discrepancy.
What is the discrepancy?
Huh?
What is the discrepancy?
The discrepancy is, we read last week in Parsha Vayera, right? That the Malachim, they came to Sodom in the evening, by Erev, right? And Lot was sitting over there, and then what did he offer them? Matzis, offer, lahem, vayochela, right?
Yeah.
Right, he baked matzis for them, and they ate. Now, if you would say, for example, okay, so he didn't have time to bake any bread, he just baked matzis for them, so then there's no kasha, okay. But the truth of the matter is that according to tradition, it happened to be the night of Pesach. And that's the reason why Lot baked matzah, okay. So what Arthur is saying over here is, if in Tishrei the Malachim came and, you know, they announced, you know, that Sarah is going to give birth, etc., etc., so how could it be, you know, that that they went on their way and they came to Sodom? Obviously, it didn't take them too long. I mean, that they had Kvitzis on Erech, I'm sure. They were able to get to Sodom that same evening, right? And it was Pesach night, so there is a discrepancy.
But you got something else, but yeah. Pesach not Yitzchak.
Okay, that's the next problem. Absolutely a problem. Okay. If Sarah conceived on Rosh Hashanah, how many months is it from Rosh Hashanah to Pesach?
Six
and a half months. All right. Maybe it happened to be an Ibiyor.
Yeah.
Okay?
Ibiyor.
So if it's an Ibiyor, right?
seven months.
It would be 7 months. Okay, all right?
So
7 months already is conceivable.
It was premature.
Right. Huh?
But it says in the following year, at the same time. So it's another problem.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that, it doesn't say that. What it says over there is certainly that, you know, a year, Kais Chaya, will a sorrow vein, that Sarah will have a son, but it doesn't say he will necessarily be born, you know, on that date. You understand? The Malach is simply saying that she will have a child.
You find somebody you like.
Right, okay. So, all right, let's say that according to this opinion, if Shitaka became pregnant on Rosh Hashanah, so the baby was born a little prematurely, maybe, somewhere between 6.5 months and 7 months or something like that. But we know that at 7 months, the child is certainly viable. And look, I mean, our ancestors had Siyata Deshmaya, they had heavenly help. And if that's the case, so even if he was born, let's say, to 6.5 months or so, he was already a viable child, okay? So Gantz find then, if we take all these statements and associate them with Tishrei, notice everything else that happened is on Rosh Hashanah of Tishrei, right? And this is Rabbi Eliezer's opinion. Now we come to the top of the next page of Daf Yud Aleph, and what do we see? We see that there is a contrary opinion, right? What is it? B'nissan nigalu. That's still a continuation of the same thing. Okay, I jumped the gun slightly. Okay, B'nissan nigalu. In the month of Nisan, our ancestors were redeemed from Egyptian slavery. In other words, there was like a 6 month period wherein the people of Israel were already preparing for the exodus from Egypt, right? And they didn't do any work anymore. Apparently the Egyptians eased up on them during that particular period. And as a result, eventually the day of the Geulah, the day of the redemption from Egypt, came in Nisan. All right. The Nisan they got there. But finishing about Tishrei, but the Tishrei Asidim Nigoyim. But when will the next Geulah come? The future redemption of our people will come on Rosh Hashanah.
It doesn't say which year here.
No, it doesn't say which year. All right. The Lubavitcher Rebbe Zechein and Levrocha had his opinion. Every year he was expecting that this was going to be the year.
You only got a few more years for the 6,000 years.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Only a few more years.
You know,
240 minus 160.
You know, if you figure out, you know, okay, for example, Tov Shin Nun, which was 10 years ago, right? Tovish Las Nisim, you know. Another one, Nisim and Nifloys, and so on and so forth, you know. Every year, you know, it's going to be the year. What Tovshin Samach is, it's a little hard for me to figure out, but I don't know. That the Smicho is something, Rabbeinu Shalom will give us some support or something like that, you know. Maybe. So, we'll have to go to the rabbi's class and find out what the Gematria is.
Yeah. What the number is called.
Right. Okay. But at any rate, Rabbi Eliezer, as we see, plays the major emphasis upon what? Upon the fact that the world was created in Tishrei. Rosh Hashanah is Tishrei, and all the good things that happened. Right. This is, huh? This is the first opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. Okay. Now we come to Rabbi Yoshua, who has a contrary theory. What is Rabbi Yoshua's theory? He says the world was created in Nisan. Benisan Noldu Avos. That's the case. When were the ancestors of our people born? They were born in Nisan. Benisan Mesu Avos. And also in Nisan, that's when the Yortzeit was, you know, for our forefathers. The Pesach Neilat Yitzhak. He's still of the same opinion that Yitzhak was born on Pesach, which would be, of course, a year after the Malachim came. Okay, the Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, that he's willing to concede that the Rosh Hashanah Nifkedah Sarah Rochel V'Chanah. That he doesn't dispute. Right, doesn't dispute either. The Rosh Hashanah Yotze Yosef Beis Vasurim, that Joseph went out of prison on that day, or the Rosh Hashanah Botla Avodah Me'Avaseinu B'Mitzrayim. Right. Doesn't dispute that, and Benisa Nigalu, right? And also that in Egypt, at the time of Egyptian slavery, they were redeemed in the month of Nisan. But when is the Geulah going to come? Benisan Asidun Nigoyim, okay? In Nisan, that will be the day when the future redemption will come, okay? So, I mean, if you're looking for a nice drash, you could always, you know, find either one. Support either for Tishrei or support for Nisan and so on, but you know that's a favorite statement. You know that Benisan Nigalu, right, and Benisan Asin Nigoy. Okay, so far we have presented the two different opinions. One of Rabbi Eliezer, who supports the Tishrei theory, right, and the other one, Rabbi Yoshua, who supports the Nisan theory. Okay, Tanya, we have a Beraisa which says. Rabbi Eliezer, Omer, Rabbi Eliezer says, Minayin Sheva Tishrei Nivrahoilam. He says, how do you know that in Tishrei, this was when the world was created? So he says, Shenema. The Pasuk says what? Vayomer Elikim, God said, Tad Sheorz Desha, let the earth bring forth vegetation, Esav Masvia Zera, grasses, you know, that will, you know, in their seeds, they will be able to carry new, you know, future grasses, eats pre, and also fruit trees. So he says, Ezehu Chodesh, which is the month, She'oretz Motziyo Deshoyim. When do we find that the ground is already brought forth all kinds of herbs, right? The Elon Molim Peros, and also the trees are just filled with fruits. We have to say Tishrei. So it's Tishrei. Not only that, he says, but the Yosah HaPerek Siman Reviya Hoyasan. That very season of the year was also the time when we have the rainy season begin. The Yordu Geshomim. And so what happened after Rabbeinu Shlomo created, you know, the various herbs and trees? So he says, then rains came. Vitzimchu. And they blossomed, Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, and this is at the beginning of chapter 2, if you remember Bereshit, the Eid Yaleh Min Haaretz, literally, and a mist rose from the ground, okay? So, and the rest of the Pasuk says, the Hishka, you know, and that watered, you know, all the trees in the garden, okay? So, that we, according to Rabbi Eliezer, the idea of creation fits in much better with the month of Tishrei than it does with Nisan. Needless to say, Rabbi Yeshua is going to dispute. Rabbi Yeshua, Omer, Minayin Sheben Nisan, he says, how do I know that the world was created in Nisan? He says, Shenemar, of course it's written. Right, exactly the same psukim.
But the best.
Right. The earth brought forth the grass, Esav Masvia Zera, right? Grass producing new grasses, the Esav Sepri, and the trees that would create fruit. He says, Ezehu Chodesh, what month is it, She'oretz Maleo Deshoyim, that we find that the month, that the earth is filled with new grasses, the Elon Motzi Peros, and the trees are, you know, like blossoming forth with new fruit, heavy on there, have to say, Zen Nisan. This is the month of Nisan. The also HaPerek, and that very season of the year, he says, this is not the rain, because it's not a rainy season, right? Instead,